What is up, WTD listeners? On today's episode, we have an Oregon alum who is a Rose Bowl champ, a Pac-12 champ, Fiesta Bowl champ, and much, much more. He spent a year with the then San Diego Chargers and is now with the Montreal Alouettes of the CFL. Please welcome Tyler Johnstone. Playing during the peak of the Win the Day era under Chip and then Coach Helfrich, I mean, what went into the preparation and how important was that in your guys' process? I mean, you were 20-1 in your first 21 games as a starter, and how were you able to compartmentalize the important tasks and have discipline there early in college where a lot of guys are making freshman mistakes and hurting the team and hurting their own future by having bad habits?
This game, you know, if you go out there and you were weak, and you had a week of practice, well, your entire team's going to suffer come Saturday because they didn't see the best, you know. And it was wasted on some guys, you know. And I think guys that came in with the attitude that they were going to come out, start, be here for 3 years, and then go number one overall in the draft, like that is a real – a lot of time for development and a lot of brain development that needs to go on and catching up to the speed of the game. But the guys that couldn't fall in line for what their role would be that season, they really struggled, and they really never – the guys that couldn't do it that year, didn't matter if they were a 4-star, 5-star, they never really recovered from their confidence woes, or a lot of them transferred. And they never made it to – you know, even if they transferred to another D1 school, they never really made anything of their football career. So I think there's a lot of mindset that goes with the redshirt year. And if you attack it, then it pays off. And if you don't, then you're probably not going to make it.
Yeah, that, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, obviously you talked about like not taking things for granted, coming into every practice, every game at 100%. And I was just wondering, like, did the staff kind of like police the weekends just to make sure like players always showed up to like games prepared and ready to give 100%, or was that, or were people just expected kind of to fall in line and whatnot?
You're pretty much expected to fall in line. You know, it's especially during season, like the weekends are so regimented, because, you know, Friday you go in for your meetings, and before the new facility, the HD Center, was built, which was finished for my sophomore season, we used to go in for our nightly, like night before the game meetings, into the Hilton downtown. Okay. Now it's the Graduate, but downtown Eugene, it was the Hilton. And we used their conference centers, and you'd sit in the group, and you'd sit with your position groups, and you'd go over everything, and then you had to stay the night there. So there's no going out, no sneaking out, bed checks. You had bed checks every time. And then, you know, obviously game day, we just bust over the facility. Even if it was a 7 p.m. game, we would wake up, shake it out with Coach Radcliffe, like a little dynamic warm-up in the morning. And then we'd go to the facility, have some meetings throughout the day. But it was really casual. You just kind of relax, but they wanted you around. Yeah, it was basically, that was pretty much what it was about. Like, everybody just, you know, everybody pretty much fell in line, but it was really regimented during season.
So going forward, you know, first 2 years, obviously team had a lot of success. There was a little hiccup at the end of your second year starting, but I mean, you guys won 23 games, and then in a span of, I believe, 9 months, you had 2 ACL tears. So mm-hmm. At that point, when things are trending high, and that's when people start talking about professional aspirations and whatnot, how does that change your mindset and the way you approach football when you go through so much, you know, hardship in such a small amount of time?
Yeah, I mean, the double ACL, that was a dagger. It was traumatic when it happened the first time in the Alamo Bowl game, because I tore my meniscus too, so it hurt. And then there were some players talking smack, so I threw my helmet at them, which you can actually see on the film of the game. It's pretty funny. But, you know, pretty much as soon as I got over that initial shock, we won the game. we all went out and partied that night, and then went home the next day, and it was New Year's Eve, and I went out with all my friends from home. And, you know, once I'd kind of come down from, like, those, like, winning that big game and, you know, kind of the initial shock of tearing it, I really settled into the fact, like, okay, I'm not doing spring ball, obviously. So what can I do to be the best resource for my team? And that was just to come back. And so I didn't have any confidence issues after that first one. I felt strong after those, like, 8 or so months. Really, really strong. And in some ways, a lot stronger than I felt before. And I didn't feel impeded at all. I felt like the exact same player I was the last season, if not a little bit stronger and even a little bit faster. And then my second day back in practice, it just tore again. Didn't hurt at all. My knee buckled when I was making a block, and I kind of fell to the ground. Coach comes running up to me with his eyes super wide, like, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay. And I was like, I know, I'm fine, didn't hurt, we're good. But then the swelling wouldn't go away, so we had it drained, and there was blood. And so tore it again. And that one was devastating, because it was like, I mean, the first thing I said was, I was in the office with Coach Greatwood, my O-line coach, my assistant O-line coach, Joe Bernardi, and then Scott Frost, Coach. You asshole.
Yeah, and we lost you at Scott Frost. If you want to go through that again real quick.
Dr. Skaggs. And Dr. Skaggs looks at the monitor and looks at us and is like, see the space right here? This space should be an ACL, but it's just space. So, and, you know, I started tearing up a little bit, and I was like, well, time to get back to work, I guess. And Coach Alfred just kind of looks at me and shakes his head, laughing. You know, he's joking, but he was just like, you asshole. And, you know, I took a walk right after that. I just, like, left. It was the middle of fall camp. I just left. That one was pretty devastating. You know, I think the first thing I said after that, I called my dad and was like, dude, if there was ever a possibility to win a national championship, it was with this team. You know, it wasn't with the team that we probably could have won it the year we beat Canada State, but we had lost to Stanford and they knocked us out. You know, we weren't all completely together my sophomore year when we won the Alamo Bowl. But this year, you could just tell, like, everybody was completely bought in. The energy was different. All the young studs had, like, become leaders, like Marcus and, you know, like Jake Fisher. A couple of the guys on defense, like Eric Armstead, Defoe, myself, like everybody was solid and knew their jobs, knew what to do. So I knew it was going to be a national championship season. We were like, I was 100% convinced we were going to win the whole thing. And that happened. And you know, I was pretty down right away from that for a little bit. I'd probably say like a week. I was really, really bummed out. And then I just kind of talked to a couple mentors of mine, and they said, look, like, the only way you're going to feel better about this is if you work your ass off to, you know, get back to where you were and then find any way you can to contribute to the team. And so that's what I did that season is I kind of took on the role of trying to be an extra coach for the younger guys. And just really support any way I could. So like early on, first few games after my surgery, I was actually up in the coach's box with a headset, and I'd be radioing down to Coach Greatwood, like, anything I saw. You know, he might have sent up questions like, hey, what happened on that play? Which we already had Coach Bernardi doing for O-line, but I was just like an extra set of eyes up there. And that was a really cool dynamic of the game I never got to see before. And then after that, once I was on the sideline, it, you know, I was just, again, an extra coach. But since they don't travel injured players, I relied on my dad's miles and some savings I had left over from the Everything Must Go thing, which is a movie. And I bought tickets to every away game. And so I went to every single away game and made sure I was on the sideline for those games, and just tried to make myself as available as possible for any kind of support and help I could be.
Absolutely. I mean that's all like, that's very admirable. And I was wondering what was the experience kind of like at transitioning from a player role to a coach role, something that you probably wouldn't have imagined you'd be doing in your time as a Duck?
It was different. I learned a lot that season, just about the game in general. I learned a lot more of the X's and O's side of things that I hadn't really delved into as deep before. And when you're looking at, like, you always kind of watch everybody else play as well, because the coach might have some coaching points for them and you can take notes. But everybody plays completely different style. And my style was being a light, fast, skinny guy and just running people into the ground and wearing them out, and just being that relentless, like, mosquito that they always had to deal with. So it gave me a chance to really break down the way other guys played the game and where they could have been lacking, or like what steps they could correct, like in their footwork and just technique overall. And so it kind of gave me this different appreciation for film that I didn't have before. And I figured out how to break it down into a much deeper level than I was able to when I was just playing as a young guy. And so I was able to learn a lot from that aspect, and really becoming kind of more of a vocal leader instead of a playing leader. It really just gave me something to do, and it made me feel needed, or benched for that reason, really struggle with. And so it gave me more of a purpose for the season, and I think that kind of kept my head above water for sure.
Definitely. So when you were able to come back the following year, I know you, before we started recording, you talked about how, I mean, that was a tough year for you physically, but did you feel like mentally on the field that what you did the prior year helped you?
I think mentally, just with understanding the game, I think it helped. One thing, though, I did not do a good enough job of, which hindsight's 2020, is I kind of thought I would just be the same player I was. And it wasn't really necessarily a physical draw or thing that kept me from doing it. It was the fact that I didn't accept the fact that I had a new body. I needed to develop a new set of skills. I had some obviously some muscle deficiencies. And so I needed to play the game at a much more technical level or figure out a technique that was going to work for me. And I never did that. I never went back to my fundamentals. I never retrained my hands, my footwork, outside of, you know, what we were already doing in practice, which we did focus on a lot of fundamentals, but I never fully retrained myself like I was a freshman again. And so I struggled because I was trying to play like a 265 pound dude that, you know, has balance in all of his muscle and all of his biomechanics and can do these things on the field that most O-linemen can't do. And I was still trying to do those things, but now I'm 305 pounds. So 40 pounds heavier. Most of it's good weight. And I just didn't have the same knee bend. I didn't have the same ability as I did before. So I had to switch up my game, and I did it. So it made it a little bit of a struggle, especially early on.
With the team success you guys ended up having on the back half of that 2015 season when Vernon got back from his injury, did that at least help kind of alleviate some of the problems you were having, like psychologically, from knowing you weren't in the same place anymore?
Yeah, you know, I think what really helped was I can remember being kind of down in the dumps a little bit about my play, mainly because I was paying too much attention to the articles that were coming out. You know, before, if there was an article about me, it always said, you know, really positive things. And so I started paying attention and kind of getting addicted to that positive feedback, you know. I'd be like, Tyler is a, you know, whatever, like a future first rounder. You know, he's on All-American watch lists, like those kind of things. And I think I got a little addicted to that. And so now this season, I started getting into my own head, because now the article was saying, well, I remember one article being like, well, Tyler's a shell of his former self. And something like that. And I was like, damn, like that sucks. Like, have I been playing like that bad? And you know, and I just knew I wasn't necessarily the same player, but I needed to figure out a way to make it work. And Coach Bernardi, our offensive coaching assistant, graduate assistant, stopped me before the ASU game when we were in the hotel, because he could tell I wasn't as vocal. I wasn't as I didn't play as angry because I was in my own head, and he made sure to light a fire under my ass. And I don't know how I made it through that triple overtime that night at all. I still don't. But I had a pretty decent game, if I can recall. And yeah, after that, I was pretty much like, okay, like I just need to light a fire every game and just go back to being the mean guy on the field. And it was hard for me to get to that place. It took a while, but especially like you said, with the struggles early season, you know, like Vernon takes a cheap shot in that first game against his old school Eastern Washington. And then, yeah, it kind of derailed the next like two or three games.
Yeah. I kind of want to go back to what you said about dealing with media scrutiny and blocking out the noise. Was that the kind of the motivation that you needed to light that fire, or did you decide more to just like block it out and kind of ignore like all the negativity that was aimed at you and the team?
I more ignored it. You know, I didn't blame the reporters for, you know, saying like, well, he's just not playing as well, because I wasn't playing as well. You know, like what they were saying wasn't untrue. So I wasn't like upset about the reporting. It's their job. They're gonna report it how it is. So I just started blocking it out. I just stopped looking at articles. I was like, it's not gonna help me. You know, before it might have helped my confidence a little bit when they're saying good things. But confidence is like 80% of the game. And if you're not playing confident and you don't think you're gonna kick the guy's ass across from you, then you're not. Like you just won't. And so once I kind of got it down, okay, like this isn't good for my confidence, I'm just gonna stop looking. I did, and I started getting a little better. But one thing, again, I found it difficult to do. Would I need to light a fire? The reason I say that is because before, I'm a big smack talker, and I didn't do any smack talking like the first half of the season. And I think I was taking the leadership role really seriously. And I knew that most guys, when they get into like a smack talking match, or they start really pissing players off on the other side, they end up feeding into it for real. And it affects their game. It makes them go after those guys instead. Maybe they start getting penalties. But I knew like the way my game was, I was only being an asshole so that they would do something to me, so I could be angry enough to play as angry as I needed to play. I would never take it too far. I only got like two or three penalties all season, like two of them being back-to-back false starts in an ASU game. But other than that, like I just use it as a way to get myself to a place where I played angry. And I knew most guys would actually get angry and start getting penalties or making stupid mistakes. So I couldn't really wear that hat anymore. But towards the end of the season, I started like bagging that and just being like, and talking to the younger guys, like, look, don't play like this. This is how I'm going to play. And then I went back to smack talking and really getting in the heads of the defenders. And that helped me out again.
So I'm glad you brought up that ASU game a couple times. That game and then Stanford were kind of the last times you saw that magic in that era of Oregon football. And what happened in the Alamo Bowl later in the year aside, were there things that were going on that you felt would, you know, become bigger issues once guys like yourself, DeForest, Rodney Hardrick, Braylon, and all those guys would move on in a year?
Yeah, you know, I think I always wondered what would happen. I was really focused on the season at the time, but, you know, once the season ended, I was like, you know, they're losing the starting quarterback again. All the leadership on the offensive line is gone. All the leadership on the on the defensive side is gone. So it was going to be complete, like, leadership turnover. And of the guys staying, there wasn't really at the time. Eventually some of the younger guys like became really solid positive leaders for the crew, but at the time there really wasn't anybody left that had been like working on, you know, becoming a better leader or taking it serious enough to be a captain or a squad leader. And so there was really just like this culture gap. And it's funny when you talk to players from any program that have had coaching turnover, there's always like weird allegiances to like the ones that recruited them and all that stuff. But I think one thing that Coach Kelly did a great job of, and why I think Coach Helfrich may have struggled just a little bit, is that our culture had lacked a lot. We did, as leaders and as like a coaching staff, I don't think we did a very good job of bringing the younger guys along, because most of them weren't really playing that much because we were a pretty old group at the time. And so that's, I think that really is what led them to falter a ton next season. There really just wasn't any leadership, and we didn't have a quarterback going into that year. So yeah, that, it was a struggle.
Well, just kind of fast forwarding a little bit. So you signed with the Chargers as an undrafted free agent, and you did a lot of great things in camp, but missed a lot of the year due to injury. Could you maybe describe some of the pressures of training camp? I know, I mean, guys are getting cut left and right, and there's a lot of pressure to perform and stay on the team. I was just wondering about the struggles.
Yeah, it's a completely different beast than like a college fall camp or obviously a high school training camp. Because, you know, in those two camps, you know that you'd have a pretty terrible camp. But, like, they're probably not going to cut you unless you actually get in trouble. You know, like, you're going to have a jersey. You're going to have a spot on the team. Which, you know, myself, I always wanted to be a starter. Other than that redshirt year, I knew I wasn't going to play. You always want to contribute in the biggest way possible. But there is, like, a sense of security. Like, I'll still be on the team, you know. But when you're a professional – just like you said, there's a ton of pressure. It's a way more complex game. There are guys in your locker room that have been there for 10 years making a ton of money. And you see that and you're like, I want to make a ton of money. Like, I want to be a 10-year vet. Like, so you try to follow what those guys do the best you can, but you realize that, okay, well, not everything that everybody's doing works for everybody. So you try to do what you can. It's so much film. The days are super long in the facility. And then if you're not watching like 3 hours of film after the fact and like really breaking down your plays, filling notebooks, just drilling X's and O's, you're not going to make it. And it's a lot of pressure. And I was probably headed to be on practice squad because I'd struggled early in the camp. I struggled pretty hard. And my coach put me on the right side. And my knee responded really well to that. And I was pretty much a different player. So I'd probably saved myself at least a spot on the practice squad with hopes of getting moved up to the roster after an injury. But yeah, pretty much during training for combine, I started feeling some foot pain building up. And one point, I even thought I'd broken it at one point because it hurt so bad after doing like 300 L-cone drills training for the combine. And I took as a sign that there's so many like roster moves and roster decisions they make in the preseason games that are kind of standard when you're in it that you'll know, okay, kind of where you stand. Like you'll know that like the last preseason game, they pretty much only play the starters, or they play the starters like the entire first half. And then they'll rotate like the guys that are going to be on the roster and rotate the second half. They won't play anybody else. The third preseason game, they want to like, that's right before the first round of cuts. And they won't play guys if they don't want to put any more film out of them. Like they want to keep them for like a practice squad situation. So I wasn't going to play. And then our special teams coordinator was scrambling, looking for a wedge blocker on the kickoff return. And I was like seventh string. And he just saw me and was like, Johnson, I'm getting there. And I was like, all right, cool. Grab my helmet. This is like third quarter in the game. I haven't played at all. Go in to do the wedge block. And I run back after the kick is made. I run back to the meetup point with the other wedge blocker, and the kick was a touchback, but I planted to turn to run towards my assignment, and I felt the outside of my foot just kind of buckle, and I was like, oh, yep, it went like that. Didn't feel good at all. And so I was in the locker room after that game. I was like limped off. I didn't tell anybody, And then, cause I wasn't sure, I didn't want to get cut, you know? So I was like, maybe it'll go away. Pain wasn't really subsiding in the locker room. And so I asked one of the older O-line vets. He'd been a guy in the league for like 9 years. He's a first round draft pick. I was like, hey man, my foot's killing me. Like, what do I do? And he gets wide-eyed and was like, you go tell them right now, like cuts are tomorrow. And the only way you're protected is if you report it. So I told the trainer, I got an x-ray 5 minutes later in the stadium. And sure enough, it was broken. So I was going to be on IR all year. And it was frustrating because it was just another season ending injury. Part of me was like, well, hey, at least I'm going to get paid now. So that was kind of nice, but ultimately that's what ended my NFL opportunity. I didn't have any film. I've had three surgeries, two of which finished seasons in the past three seasons. So, you know, I had some tryouts and both times they kept me over a bunch of other guys that were in the tryouts, both on the Saints and the Texans the next season. But ultimately they brought me aside and said, hey, we thought you did a great job. We're going to keep you on our radar, but the deal is these guys haven't ever had an injury. So we need bodies more than anything. And so that's when I decided to go up to CFL. That way I could get some film and maybe break back into the NFL.
I mean, I have to think, even though it didn't work out as planned round one, I mean, for a lot of guys, they never even get to end up in an NFL camp. And I'm sure going, you know, five years ago, you're in high school, then all of a sudden you're in the NFL in some capacity, at least training camp. So I'd have to think there's some kind of positive. And like when you reflect back on it, you know, it's something you can be proud of and have pride about.
100%, man. And, you know, when I was like 10 years old, I told my dad, you know, someday I'm going to make it to the NFL, you know? And he was kind of like, he didn't put down my dream or anything. He was just kind of like, all right. Like, he also didn't want to be like, yep, you got it. You're going to be an NFL player. Cause he knew the statistics and I was 10. And, he was just like, well, you're going to have to work really hard. And I was like, I know I will. And so my goal had always been to make it. And so I was able to cross that goal off. But the biggest positive that came out of that year with the Chargers was, I met my best man on the team, and then my now wife and I, she was my girlfriend at the time. We, all three of us, my best man, her and I, we all lived together beachfront all year. And it was like the best year of all time. We got engaged there. We just had so much fun. So much fun. It was probably the best year ever. it was fantastic. And we wouldn't have gotten that experience had it not been for that situation.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Before we wrap it up, I do want to talk about the CFL. And I know I've heard from different guys, they have different experiences. But when you got to the CFL, I'm just curious, what are the things that you think are better for guys versus the things that this could be improved about the playing experience?
So I think the game is more fun up there. It just is. It's quicker. There's like the three downs, the bigger field, makes for more big play opportunities. And there's only nine teams, but you play 18 games. So you really, really get to know everybody in the league. So it's kind of like, it's almost like playing in like a beer softball league. You know what I mean? Like, you know, everybody in the league, you know, everybody that's playing, and like, you kind of have, like, there's guys that you don't like, of course, but like, you have to have some kind of respect. You're going to be seeing those guys 2-3 times a season sometimes. And so I think the game is more fun. There's also a rule where the defensive line is actually a yard off the ball. They're not right on the ball. And at first I thought that was going to be a big headache, a big adjustment. But it being a passing league pretty much up there, because three downs, it makes it so much easier. As long as you're patient, you just take your set, and normally, like, you're like, okay, I have a freak athlete right on the ball. My only advantage is that I know the snap count, but this fool has all the forward lean. He's going to have a better get off than I can going backwards with one leg. And it's stressful, but there it's like, okay, they're yard off the ball. It doesn't matter where they line up now. Like, I'm always in position. I just got to be patient. And so only struggle I saw from American players that played O-line was that they weren't patient and they would get too busy with their footwork or their hands, and then they would like take themselves out of the block. But if you were just patient, it was a lot of fun. And then I think what they do a good job up there compared to anywhere else is they really take care of the players in workload. Like the NFL, I think there's rules, but you're going to be in the building at least like 9 hours a day during season. There's a lot more time commitments than that as well. CFL, they can only require you be in the building for meetings, practice, lifting, whatever, for 4.5 hours. After camp, there's no pads in practice all season. So it's helmets only all season. And so they take care. Oh, there's also like 3 bye weeks. So it's a long season, but they do a really good job of trying to take care of the players' bodies, which is good. Now, what they could do better, which kind of comes with financial strain, is the organizations just aren't really run as tight ship as, you know, what I'd experienced, you know, with an NFL team. And then especially not like from Oregon, because Oregon ran a tight, tight ship. You know, everything was handled. Whereas there's a lot of confusion when you go up there. You know, there's a lot of staff turnover because there's not as much money in it. So like our GM's changed over. Our first GM promised a ton of stuff that he just had no ability to follow up on. And then they're just understaffed because of finances. So there's only 2 trainers for the whole football team. Like, and, you know, if you're an injured guy, they really don't. There's not much they can do. They don't really have any equipment. My high school facility, which wasn't a nice facility, had better like treatment equipment than the Alouettes did, for example. And so it's more, the things they can do better are more like organizational and like treatment type deals. Cause that's standard across the CFL. It's not just with one team. So it's just a different league for sure.
Definitely, and I definitely appreciate the insight. And last thing before we let you go is, I think everyone, you know, Oregon fans like to keep up, and so I'm just curious, what do you see in the next 2 to 3 years for yourself?
You know, it really depends on what happens this season. You know, we haven't even gotten a confirmation when, because like pre-COVID, I'm in camp right now. I'm still in Eugene, still, you know, with my wife, son, dog here. And we haven't really had any word what's going to happen. Earliest start date originally was going to be June, but Canada's a lot stricter in handling the crisis than the U.S. is. So June is definitely not going to happen. What our PA is fighting for is like a half season, like 9-game season. And the reason I say it depends on this season is, you know, at some point going to have to, you know, do the next thing. And I got a job right now in order to, you know, work through this time. But I don't think if this season ends, you know, I don't want to say anything for sure, but if we don't have a season this year, I don't really see myself going back. Because the ultimate goal for me is to get back to the NFL. And if you know, I can't get the film on, at this point, I'm only getting older. You know, so the first opportunity, if this season doesn't happen, to get in the NFL, I'll be, you know, 30 years old. And, you know, with a couple knee surgeries and the foot surgery, and that's if I'm healthy all the way through. So we'd have to reevaluate, I think. But if the season does happen, then it kind of all depends, you know, on this season. If I have a great year and some great film and put out some feelers to see if there's anything going on, because this is my last year with the Alouettes based on this contract. So it really all depends on what happens this year going forward. But, yeah, this is likely going to be my last season.
For sure, yeah. I mean, I know gyms just opened in Eugene, like, on Friday. So I imagine it's probably not super easy to prepare and all that.
Yeah, I mean, especially you got to understand, too, like, there's travel restrictions, right? And 50, if not 60% of that league are American players or international players. So they can't even get into the country right now. I'm a dual citizen, so after some headaches, I could probably get over there. But the rest of the American guys now that they're shut out. So we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, definitely appreciate your time, man. We wish you all the best, and regardless of what happens, I'm sure you're going to have great things in store. So thank you again.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, no, I appreciate it, man. Go Ducks. Always got to help the Duck family out.
Go Ducks.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for coming on.